This is No More Normal. I'm Khalil Colonna. Millions of people around the U.S. have already voted early. Simultaneously, many people are preparing to fill out their ballots but are concerned with how they will deliver them and, more importantly, if their vote will be counted. So many questions. Here at Nomona, we are going to dig deep to find answers for you. This is about preserving and exercising your right to vote.
So-called poll challengers. They have to be registered voters in their community. They have to be trained. They have to follow very strict statutes about what they can and cannot do in a polling place. One of the things they cannot do is interact directly with a voter.
That is New Mexico Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse Oliver. Today, we'll talk with her, the president of the local Postal Workers Union, a national election law expert, activists who are protecting voting rights for underserved communities, and voters. A quick note, some of these interviews we did early on in the week before President Trump revealed he had contracted coronavirus. Here we go. Nomona starts now. My first guest today is Matthew Wheel. He's the Elections Project Director for the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank in D.C. Everyone is looking closely at election law the last few days. I asked him about what courses of action political parties would take if a presidential candidate dies before the election.
So both parties have their own rules in their charters. And so, yes, in that situation, both parties would have the ability to work through their membership to select new candidates.
Does that situation change if a candidate were to die after the election?
So after the election is a much bigger mess.
Okay.
Now we're talking about getting into how electors might choose to cast their ballots when the Electoral College meets in the states on December 14th.
Is there a federal mandate that the electors actually cast their votes for that deceased candidate, or can they choose someone of their own liking? I'm sure the party would get together on that.
So just like with most things in elections, there's no national mandate. In fact, some states actually have laws that theoretically bind those electors to that dead candidate. Now, if somebody were to die who's on the ballot, I have to imagine that the parties and the states would release them from that obligation. But this is what I'm talking about. This is a big mess of situation after Election Day.
Are they obligated by the states to follow the will of the people if the people vote for a certain person?
Electors have a lot of free range here. I mean, in many states, they can vote their conscience. Now, they tend to be party loyalists, and so it doesn't happen very often. But there are what's called faithless electors. It's happened before. It's happened in 2016. I will note, though, that there's an even more confusing situation if the candidate dies after the Electoral College votes are cast. That's an even more confusing time.
What happens then?
Then those ballots have been cast. Congress on January 6th is going to open up the results from the states. At that point, those votes can't be changed. Those electors' votes have been cast. And so Congress will have to adjudicate what happened to that point.
Question regarding Congress. We've heard that if the Electoral College cannot come to a clear winner, the vote then goes to the House of Representatives, where each state gets one vote for president. Does the current Congress take on that vote, or is it the new Congress that's elected?
So the new Congress will be sworn in on January 3rd and Electoral College Day January 6th, so it'll be the new Congress.
What is the likelihood of that type of situation occurring?
I have no way to prognosticate whether or not any candidate would die. It would be a mess. I mean, this is something that I think there's been a lot of wargaming, and right now Republicans hold 26 state delegations, so they hold a majority. If they were to lose one, which is certainly a possibility based on current polling, that's where you get into situations where there may not be somebody who can be elected before Inauguration Day, and then you would start going to the Presidential Succession Act.
Would that then go to the Speaker of the House, i.e. Nancy Pelosi, in this situation?
She would be sworn in as the acting president. Now, if Congress eventually does decide on who won the election, she would be bumped out of that, and of course, to be inaugurated president, she would have to resign her speakership and resign from Congress, so that would be a weird situation in itself now.
Okay. And this week has been kind of almost the perfect storm as far as incidents to go down. Tuesday night was the debate that a lot of people were talking about until Thursday night's news that the president and the first lady tested positive for COVID-19. Does the president's illness, does this overshadow his unhinged debate tactics?
I mean, I think it does, because now we're not talking about it anymore, certainly.
Yeah.
And I think the real question is whether or not we're going to see any more debates. And it's hard to imagine how we do more in-person debates, and we try to do a remote debate. What does that look like? So I do think it does change the trajectory. It moves us off that conversation about that mess of a debate and focuses the attention again back onto the coronavirus.
Hopefully, as this situation continues to unfold, we can talk again. He is Matthew Wheel. He is the Elections Project Director for the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Matthew, thank you again for your time.
Thank you for having me.
My next guest is Lana Atkinson. She is the director for the University of New Mexico Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy. Lana, thanks for being with me.
Oh, I'm glad to be here today. Thank you.
News broke last night that President Trump and the First Lady have coronavirus. So tell me, what has your day been like? What type of conversations have you been having?
I've just been getting a lot of calls from different people asking about the implications for the election and possibly for post-election. What are the possible scenarios that could play out in that? You know, I've been trying to look at the laws related to succession and the party laws and thinking about trying to figure out all the options.
Let's get into some of the options. Well, voting is already underway. What happens if one of the candidates is no longer an option, maybe because of their health?
Right. So if someone were to die, the vice presidential candidate would just become the candidate, and that's really quite straightforward in a way. If they were to withdraw, that's not clear, because that's not really set up the same way.
Okay.
Withdrawal would be much more complicated. The first thing that would have to happen is that the party would have to nominate someone else. So they'd have to somehow create a process to select a nominee. Then that could be complicated because people have already voted. You can't really vote for a person who's not on a ballot. So you'd probably have to take it for the Supreme Court. Could you count votes for one Republican Party nominee for another Republican nominee or Democratic nominee? I guess if things were to change just across the board.
Is there any argument to be made that since Trump can't campaign during this crucial time in the electoral season, that the election should be postponed?
No, the election cannot be postponed. I mean, that would take an act of Congress to change the law. There's no way anyone's changing or postponing voting. I mean, we are in process. People have already voted. There's just no way. I mean, whatever happens, whether someone gets more incapacitated and the vice president has to take over for a short time or the rest of a term, or, you know, whether someone will withdraw. Now, that's the thing that would really throw things into the ringer. If one of the candidates had to withdraw for some reason, for health reasons, that would be very complex because those ballots are already printed. And how would we judge ballots? Most states don't allow you to take back your ballot once it's voted. So I think there's about 7 states that do. That would be a real problem, right? People are voting for people and you have to count the votes for those people. So you'd have to go to the Supreme Court and have some sort of ruling about what those votes meant. Who knows what they would say?
The last general election cycle, we saw Trump win, even though the polls beforehand pointed to him losing. Again, we're seeing the polls saying that he won't win. How much faith do you have in these polls?
The best predictor of the Electoral College is the popular vote. And that's right, literally, like 95% of the time. But so I think there's a lot more state polls going on this year, which are help bolstering that. Could there be shy Trump supporters? You know, there could be 1 or 2%. You know, I might expect changes of that much. You know, I mean, I do believe the polls are accurate in terms of what's happening now. Things can always change.
What are you keeping your eye on as we move forward?
I'm keeping my eyes on the number of rejected ballots and how that's changing in states. North Carolina is publishing reports about this regularly. And so, you know, they have a pretty good vote by mail system, actually, and they have really good records. So you can look at that and see what ballot rejections are. I am concerned about the potential for many ballot rejections that might make people feel that the election is not as legitimate, again, on both sides. And ballot rejections are going to happen. I mean, that's not a voter suppression issue per se. I mean, it's a issue of ballots come in late. They come in without the proper authentication. I'm concerned about a potential of a lot of uncounted ballots that makes the election perceived as less legitimate.
I hear you. Now, when we talked Wednesday, I asked you if you'd come on the show to talk about any developments. I didn't expect you to come back to the show so quickly, but I want to thank you so much for making time to speak with us and to really explain this very unprecedented and nuanced situation. She's Lana Atkinson, the director of the University of New Mexico Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy. Lana, thanks again.
Okay, thank you so much.
We're launching the Voices Behind the Vote series this week, where we find out about who voters are and what they care about. You can expect to hear from voters on this show and in the KUNM News broadcast up until the election. We've got a couple in today's episode. First up, executive producer Marisa DeMarco catches up with Art Simone, who was her editor when she was a student reporter nearly 20 years ago.
Well, when I pulled up today, you said to me something that I think you used to say to me all the time in the newsroom, like, what we got today, because you were my boss.
I'm Arthur Simone, and I'm voting for the second time in my life. I'm 46 years old, so that's not a very good batting average, I guess, but I'm here and ready to vote. For a long time, I kind of subscribed to the view that I was, you know, this rugged individualist, and whoever was elected didn't affect me or my family, and I don't think that that is the case. Now, I feel like if we don't vote and change the tide, so to speak, that we're not going to have the opportunity to vote in 4 years, in 8 years, and that choice is going to be taken away from us. I think I've evolved. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I was probably borderline conservative. We're on the west side. We're in the Bosque. This is the Atrisco area. I guess you would call it the West Side Bluffs, because we have the bluffs right over the river right there. When we moved here, my parents, this was all sand. There was that one little housing development. Just recently, with the pandemic and just the disregard for human life, we have a commander-in-chief that is a white supremacist, or at the very least, panders to a base of white supremacists. And there's kids in cages right now. There's really no concrete action for equality for people of color. It's all on the surface. Police brutality is not getting any better. And if we don't put a stop to that now, with, you know, the power of our vote, it's going to get worse. I think that we need to operate within the parameters of what our country has been based upon. Voting has been our primary source of power, you know, as people since this country was established. I'm hoping that things go well and he does stand down if he's not reelected. And then, you know, we have more work ahead of us.
Excuse me, we're standing on it. I hope we can stand on it. It's a metaphor, no.
I think about my daughters and it scares me to think that they could be targeted and people like them targeted because of their choice of who they are or their skin color. I think my generation is responsible for where we're at. Me, a prime example of my apathy towards voting, but also we're responsible for being the placeholders so people of that age and younger can kind of get this country through an evolution and make it better.
I can't believe your kids are so big.
2001 is when we worked together last. Yeah. It's nuts.
It's been a while.
I have never looked back on that at all. I don't think I've written in probably 15 years. I coach wrestling, boys and girls wrestling, and I coach girls soccer at West Mesa. I see a lot of people my age kind of passing the buck and seeing all this generation. 95% of the kids that I deal with on a daily basis are kinder, more empathetic, think with more reason than most of the people my age I come in contact. People my age and a little bit younger need to take responsibility for what we've created, and that starts with voting. We're looking at a lot of chamisa right now, some cacti, lots of little desert flowers that I have no idea what they are. And then, of course, there's all the cottonwoods in the valley right there. And you can see probably one of the best views in the city of the sandias from here. For some reason, I had kind of ignored this area growing up and, you know, in my early adulthood. But when I moved back from California, this was the first place I came. And I started to run this route and just kind of, it was a very meditative space and I'd think a lot. It's a very specific place that feels like home to me. My kids live in this area too, so they get to see the same things. They'll text me, did you see that sunrise this morning? Were you running? And I'm like, yeah. It's just something worth saving. And that's why voting's important.
For years, Common Cause New Mexico has been protecting voters' rights and working for a much more ethical and open government. I'm here with the executive director, Heather Ferguson. Heather, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having us on.
So tell me about the voter protection and this voter protection hotline. How does this work and where can people reach out?
Well, the voter election protection hotline has been up and running since 2001. It is the longest running election protection program that is nonpartisan in our history. And what we do is we run a nationwide hotline. And for here in New Mexico, there will be New Mexico specific attorneys that will be answering election questions that are coming in from our state. Nationwide, right now, we have over 12,000 volunteers that will be working with field programs that we have in 39 states. But we have the election protection hotline running in every single state. So we are still looking for more volunteers, actually. So folks who are interested can sign up at protectthevote.net.
What is a circumstance in where someone would want to call the election protection hotline?
So if they are seeing something at the polls that appears to them to be out of the ordinary, if they are witnessing coercion, if they're witnessing incidents of intimidation or voter suppression, for example, here in New Mexico, we've got this New Mexico Civil Guard militia group. Mm-hmm. If those guys are standing outside holding their, you know, giant rifles and intimidating voters away from the polling locations, that's exactly when they need to call the 1-866 Our Vote hotline so that we can get some folks on top of getting that helped out.
In a situation like that, would law enforcement be involved?
So we do have a penalties code in the New Mexico statutes. And typically what would happen in that instance is, since it is a statewide election, the New Mexico State Police would likely be called rather than the local law enforcement.
Okay.
And of course, the county clerk's office and the Secretary of State's office would be involved.
To take a look at history, the right to vote by unrepresented and underrepresented groups has been under attack from pretty much the creation of the Constitution. As soon as a group achieves the right to vote, forces that are working to erode those rights immediately, they rise up. Now in 2020, it seems to be the perfect storm for voter suppression, voter intimidation, and election manipulation by the administration and others. What do people need to know about this? How can we assure that people can be aware and confident that their voting rights will be maintained?
I think that the public should know that there is a tremendous amount of attention on this from the incredible increase of volunteers that we've had through the election protection program. What we're encouraging the public to do is be an October voter. Make a plan to vote. Please request your absentee ballot here in New Mexico. They will start mailing those out on October 6th. You can also early vote at your county clerk location as of October 6th. And then as of October 17th, you can go to the voting convenience centers if you choose to vote in person, or as soon as you get your absentee ballot. We are really encouraging people, don't hesitate, don't wait, fill it out when you get it. And if you're going to drop it in the mail, do it right away. Everything needs to try to be done in October. Or if they want to wait till election day, that's fine too. We just think that it's really important that everybody who ensures that their ballot gets in there by November 3rd.
October voters, that's the new style from here on forward. I like that a lot. She is the executive director for Common Cause New Mexico, Heather Ferguson. Heather, thank you again for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
You can imagine that the Nomono team has been talking about little besides the election and how to cover it all week. This is what we're working on for the duration. We're starting this special run of shows by talking about voting, a hard-won right that we have to keep fighting for. Reflecting on that, here's an editorial from me and from the show. The tumultuous winds of 2020 have thrust our collective beings into the air, thrashing us about, blowing through any sense of normalcy, mental clarity, and emotional groundedness. Some of us, not all, are recognizing the things we took for granted in our lives. Some took for granted the unwritten set of rules or principles in presidential politics. Yes, last week's debate was not the one we needed, but the one we deserved. That's easy to see. Even as the term bipartisan has been eroded from our vocabulary, it's bound to be on a list of endangered words sometime soon. The usual explanation is that there are two Americas now, conveniently referred to as the right and the left, the red and the blue. However, that's not correct. There are 328 million Americas, and each one is different. We all have our perception of what this country was, is, and what it should be. We're all grabbing onto the flag, pulling it towards us, so that the dream we were sold would have a chance of becoming true. Anything pulled in 328 million different directions is bound to strain and tear. America is no different. We're here at a moment where our flag is held together by one thread, the thread that binds us as members of a democracy. Our vote is that thread. Now we must come together and figure out how to work together as humans, as a country, to weave a new fabric of the nation. There's more on the ballot than the presidential race. Your Congress people have made decisions about relief packages that are keeping many people across America afloat, for instance. Judges, too, are on your ballots as you weigh criminal justice reform and eviction moratoriums, and plenty more. Local politicians have impacted your life lately more than ever, and we're going to try to make sure we have answers for you about the decisions they've made as you cast your ballots. Maggie Toulouse Oliver is the Secretary of State for New Mexico. That means she's coordinating the state's election process. Hence, she's very busy. I caught up with her and asked her about the types of conversations she's had with postal officials and the confidence New Mexicans can have in the voting process.
The entire election mail process, I've been fortunate, along with my colleagues in the National Association of Secretaries of State, to have had two really robust conversations with the U.S. Postmaster General himself, along with his senior your staff. And basically, what we have been wanting to ascertain is just to make sure that, you know, the Postal Service is up to the challenge of meeting the needs of voters and election officials. Mm-hmm. They have affirmed to us on multiple occasions that not only are they up to the task, but this is their number one priority.
Of the people who are planning to vote by mail, should they have any concerns? And what can they do to make sure that their ballots are counted?
Folks should first and foremost feel like they can trust the Postal Service and the vote by mail process. We are in regular communication with USPS and working closely together with them. But it's really important that folks also understand that there are some limitations to what the Postal Service can do. They're not magicians at the end of the day. So we need to make sure everyone who can is giving the Postal Service at least 7 days. So when a ballot is mailed from the county clerk's office, give it about 7 days to arrive in your mailbox. Also, that folks should make sure if they're going to mail their ballot back, that they do it no later than October 27th, which is a week before Election Day, to make sure that it does arrive in time to be counted. And you can track your ballot on nmvote.org and make sure that it does get back to the county clerk's office in time.
The president has made many unfounded accusations of voter fraud, to the point that he's mentioned having federal agents and his polling volunteers, his sheriffs, he calls them, to go and monitor polling places. With what we've seen from militia groups and Trump supporters in response to the BLM protests, where violence and intimidation are very much on display. In June, Albuquerque even made the national news for the shooting of a protester at the Oñate statue in Old Town Albuquerque. Got a few questions related to the growing tension some may feel about this in person. Is monitoring of polling places by non-officials, is that legal?
We do, of course, allow for some public observation of the election process, but it's very limited. The political parties, Democratic, Republican, Libertarian, can appoint so-called poll challengers. They have to be registered voters in their community. They have to be trained. They have to follow very strict statutes about what they can and cannot do in a polling place. One of the things they cannot do is interact directly with a voter and or obstruct the election process in any way. And so if their activities are in any way keeping voters from exercising their right to vote, then they have to be removed from the polling place. Furthermore, it's really important for folks to know that law enforcement generally are forbidden from being anywhere near a polling place unless there is a direct need to respond to a public safety call. So a poll judge or county clerk can, you know, call and ask, we're having a concern for public safety, please come address this. But otherwise, they are forbidden from being anywhere near a polling place.
Are you worried that as the count continues, tensions will rise? And do you have plans or thoughts around that?
Unfortunately, I think that we're just in very fraught times here in this country, here in the state. Political polarization is extreme right now. Toxic partisan rhetoric is extreme. The presidential election in particular is quite fraught. I think anyone who watched the debate the other night really intimately understands that. Mm-hmm. What I think is important for everybody to know and understand is that, you know, our democracy has survived and thrived through many difficult times in our nation's history. And I think this time will be no different.
Question for you between now and Inauguration Day. How are you going to get any sleep?
You know, this is the challenge of being an election administrator. We know our job becomes a 24/7 job, and that's just the reality. So I do look forward to finally getting a nap, maybe over the Thanksgiving holiday, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Maggie Toulouse Oliver is the Secretary of State for the great state of New Mexico. Madam Secretary, thank you for being on the show again. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is No More Normal. I'm Khalil A. Colonna. For the first half of the show, we've been talking about the election process and digging through possible scenarios. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to hear from more voters, and we're going to set our attention to voting rights, about what they are and who has to keep fighting for access. We talk to activists and leaders about the people's right to vote. Your right. Stick with Nimona. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the New Mexico Local News Fund, the Kellogg Foundation, and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation. Hear us each week on KUNM, Sundays at 11 a.m. Find past episodes online at KUNM.org or wherever you look for podcasts. Speaking of our mail system, the Postal Service has been in the spotlight this year as millions of Americans prepare to vote by mail due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Actions by the administration to place cuts on the Postal Service has not only drawn scrutiny, but raised questions about the previously mentioned millions of ballots and whether voters can be sure that their vote will be where it needs to be on time. I spoke with Ken Fajardo, president of the American Postal Workers Union, Local 380, Albuquerque. Ken, thanks for being with me today.
My pleasure to be here.
So postal workers have a job that's important every day. But right now there's a lot of pressure on post offices. It kind of seems like our democracy is counting on you all. How does that feel for yourself and the people you work with?
It's very gratifying. Postal workers are very conscientious and very proud of the work that we do. Not that we're in it for the recognition, but it's nice to be recognized. We're up to the challenge. We do it every election.
And it's something where people have not really, you know, paid attention to that in years past. People have been voting for mail for decades now. I think that's something with 2020. We're recognizing how important some of the things we take for granted are. Is that kind of the feeling that you and your colleagues are having?
The spotlight is on the Postal Service. We do this year in, year out, day in, day out. We always get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Now, how can we voters help you all out in completing this very important task?
My recommendation, request the application for a ballot as early as possible. Once you receive that, the application, send it out as soon as you get it. And once you receive the ballot, get it in the mail as soon as possible. Do not wait till the last day, because at that point, your vote may be in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. Do not waste any time. Earlier in the summer, when there were changes made at the Postal Service, one of the things that was talked about was the disassembling of mail sorting machines, and come to find that one was removed from Albuquerque. Why did that happen?
They did it, according to the Postmaster General, to cut costs. But I think the timing of the removal of the machines has to be called into question. We were earmarked to lose an additional three on top of that. They have since pulled back.
So what does this mean for postal workers right now? What extra burden does that put on you?
Like I said, we're up to the challenge, but we need the tools, the resources to get the job done. If you're pulling out these machines, that's one less machine that we have the capacity to run the mail that needs to be run. It's not uncommon to have a machine that's not utilized, but these are very high-tech machines, and they tend to break down on occasion. Sometimes it takes a while to get them up and running again. So it's good to have that backup.
And your fear that this one particular backup is being taken down. So given the flood of extra mail that you're expecting in the coming weeks, having this backup down is potentially going to slow down the process of doing what you all do every day.
The potential is there.
Now, do you have any worries at all about this election season?
You know, if you would ask me that a month and a half ago, yeah, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But postal management, the powers that be up in D.C., they're now putting the emphasis where it needs to be. which is the elections.
Yeah.
It's a priority.
Yeah.
Just the fact that they pulled back on their agenda to pull out machines puts us in a better position.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, we do lose that one machine, but it's better than losing four machines.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, the president is saying that there'll be voter fraud because so many people are using absentee ballots. What's the post office's role in making sure that that doesn't happen?
The post office takes the elections very seriously. We have managers that are working very closely with the county clerks to ensure that there is no fraud or delays in mail. Election mail is basically put at the top in order to expedite it, that it is taken very seriously. As for fraud, I'm not aware of any fraud going on.
You know, how do you think your colleagues are holding up? I know you all are ready to take the challenge and to do this job that you've been doing every day.
We lean on each other, and it has been a very stressful year. In light of the pandemic, we've been dealing with package volume equivalent to Christmas time. So this is basically like Christmas on steroids for the last 8 months.
I want to thank you very much for taking time to be on the show. He is Ken Fajardo. He is the president of the American Postal Workers Union, Albuquerque Local 380 chapter. Thank you for being on the show, and thank you for all of the work that you've been doing.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Half of the millennial and Gen Z voters who plan to cast their ballots for Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden aren't very enthusiastic about him, according to a survey by the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. Reporter Nash Jones spoke with Raina Davis, a 23-year-old Albuquerque voter who, while not particularly excited about her options for president, sees voting as harm reduction and as one facet of fighting for reproductive justice.
Hi, my name is Raina Davis, and we're sitting here in the UNM Women's Resource Center, a place definitely very near and dear to my heart. So my freshman year at UNM, I was really lucky to be introduced to this place and start working here, and I've actually grown to become professional staff. We're in our conference room where we usually hold a bunch of workshops and advisement and things like that, and it's been really tough, especially during this pandemic. You know, now we have our services still, of course, but we don't have our regulars coming in saying hello. So it's been really hard to kind of be in the office without the normal buzz. I'm classified as a professional intern where I focus on self-care, harm reduction, and community outreach, community engagement. Writing has always been a really big part of who I am too. I have a blog now since quarantine. So I started doing feminist analysis of horror films for fun. I identify as Chicana, and then I also identify as mixed race. My family's so important to me. I did have an ill parent a couple times in my life, and so really kind of taking on a caretaker role really young has been really eye-opening. My identities and my values I hold so dear to me, so I really study the representatives and the candidates that are supposed to represent me and my voice. Because I understand that you're not just one thing. Everything is super intersectional. So for me, a big thing is reproductive justice, not just abortion or healthcare access, but the right to parent. Also the prison industrial complex, like tackling all these things that pertain to families, autonomy, and choice. That's been a really big thing for me, especially within the work that I do. We try and empower our students. And I think a really big part of empowerment is autonomy and stability and safety. So that's really been informing kind of where I'm looking politically. You really have to look for candidates that really do talk about reproductive justice. I still think that's kind of an issue as well, is that we really aren't still able to talk about what reproductive rights and justice is. Although the body is a political space, period, right? Like internally or how we access space. It's a little absent from the forefront of our conversations because people are scared to talk about them, and that sucks. Like, I think these are conversations that we have to progress and to advocate for our communities effectively. I've definitely like looked to orgs that I admire, and they've had like a lot of lists of like resources to find like who's your representative, what district are you in, and that's not something I did really before. I mean, I did close to an election, but I don't do consistently. It's like, hey, like why am I not actually engaging with these people more than a month before? When I turned 18, I was so excited to vote. I always joke that I voted for like every pothole in the city. I wasn't super stoked to vote in 2016. It felt like lesser of two evils. And it kind of it feels like that now as well. But I've really focused on voting as a harm reduction strategy. It's which administration do I want to fight up against, right? As opposed to which administration is going to save us all. I don't. That's not how that works. And care has always been holistic. You can't only do one thing. It's yes, vote, and also engage in local politics. Also do direct action community care and teach and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm all registered. I'm good. I'm good to go. I'm going to vote in person. I don't know. I think that there was a lot of really negative things going on with, like, the mailing system and things like that I was just like, okay, no. Like, but I also think that it's a legitimate and safe way to cast your ballot. I just personally want to mark the bubble and hear the ding. Voting is really important, and there's a lot of folks that can't, which is a whole conversation of itself that we need to have. So yeah, go vote. I love voting. My name's Raina Davis, and I love voting.
I'm here with Rachel Biggs. She is the policy director for the Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless. Rachel, thank you for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So many people don't know that they can register to vote in New Mexico, even if they don't have a home address.
Unfortunately, each election, people with low incomes and people experiencing homelessness really vote at lower rates than people with higher incomes, despite the fact that many of the policies being decided at the polls really directly impact people that are economically disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And not having the information is one of the barriers that definitely keeps people from registering and voting. But it is true, you in fact do not need a home to vote, and that you don't have to have a traditional residence to register to vote. And there's ways to do that.
Why don't we know this?
I think historically there's been a lot of structural issues that have kept people living with low incomes, living on the street, in those positions. And this is just another example of some of the structural issues that keep people from being able to participate in public policy decisions that really affect their lives directly.
That's absolutely ridiculous that we don't know this information, given what you said about the importance of these decisions. Tell me, how are you all working on that issue here in the state?
We're a federally qualified health center, and the health center movement really does do a lot around voter registration and help get out the vote efforts. And so at Healthcare for the Homeless, we do a lot of education around people's rights and making sure people understand that they can still register to vote. Not having an address can be overcome. You can draw a map on your registration ballot. You can indicate on the residence line that you're at a non-traditional address, mm-hmm. and in fact state the intersection that you reside closest to. You do have to include a mailing address. This is important, so you don't get your ballot, your registration thrown out. You can have a non-traditional address in that residence line. You can draw a map, but you still will have to include a mailing address. Mm-hmm. But this mailing address could be a PO box, it could be a friend or family member's address, or any other place you receive mail. And that mailing address does not have to be in the county that you reside in. It just needs to be an address where you can receive mail.
Now, nationwide, we've been hearing and seeing that more people are losing their homes or are about to lose their homes due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And while the election might be the last thing on their minds, government officials made the calls during the pandemic that put people in that very position. How do you convince people that voting matters while they're going through such turmoil and hardship?
Public policy is really decided at the polls. Yeah. And so when we're having these conversations with individuals that are really going through a crisis, the experience of homelessness, losing your home is a high crisis situation. But we really try to convey this, how critically important it is for people that are in that position to use their voice to vote on the issues that are really directly affecting them, which includes affordable housing, access to healthcare, a living wage. These are issues that just have a direct impact on people's lives right now in a really real way. And people are seeing this so clearly with COVID and really seeing the connection between public policy and housing and homelessness. And unfortunately, people are at really high risk of homelessness right now. Mm-hmm. We're anticipating an increase of 40% to 45% increase in people experiencing homelessness due to COVID. So we're preparing for that. And this is exactly why it's so important for people to exercise their right to vote and get to the polls and have an impact on these public policy decisions.
Are you seeing anything unusual nationally unfolding?
Of course, the biggest barrier that we're hearing from all of our partners is that mail-in ballot and people not having an address and how hard that is for individuals to access a mail-in ballot and be able to vote by mail. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're really concerned with the impact of COVID on people experiencing homelessness being at particularly high risk and particularly vulnerable to negative impacts from COVID. Going on general election day, being in congregate settings, the mail-in ballots would be obviously the best scenario, but that's hard for individuals without a steady address that they can receive mail for that mail-in ballot.
She is Rachel Biggs, the policy director for Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless. Rachel, thank you again for being on with me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your time, and thanks for covering this important issue.
And one more time, a reminder that the last day in New Mexico to register to vote by mail or online is Tuesday, October 6th. But you can register in person at your county clerk's office all the way up through Halloween. Reverend William Barber has traveled to New Mexico and all around the country organizing with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. The movement extends from the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Cesar Chavez, with a vision of poor and low-wealth people and their moral allies coming together to make systemic change. Reporter Russell Contreras spoke with Reverend Barber for New Mexico PBS and asked him why poverty should be on the agenda during the 2020 elections in New Mexico.
My question is, how can it not be? That's what we have said to candidates that are here. How in the world can you choose not to address an issue that's affecting almost 43% of the nation? I mean, how can you not address an issue where, for instance, if you just pay people a living wage, $15 an hour, you could bring 49 million people out of poverty?
What would you like to see both President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden say during the debates to address poverty? What kind of questions should the moderators be asking to bring the issue of poverty into this presidential campaign?
One of the things I want to acknowledge these numbers, 58% of all the children, 49% of women, 58% of people of color, 35% people that are white in New Mexico are poor and low wealth. In New Mexico, you've got 230,000 people that are uninsured. So first of all, I want them to acknowledge the numbers and the people represented by the numbers. And then I want them to say how they will address these five interlocking injustices: systemic racism and all of its reality, police violence, yes, but also voter suppression, also continuing underfunding and resegregation of public schools and mass incarceration and the mistreatment of our immigrant brothers and sisters, Latino brothers and sisters, our mistreatment of indigenous brothers and sisters, but then also address poverty and the lack of living wages and ecological devastation. They have to address the issues, not talk around them, not just come up with nice metaphors. We ought to be concerned. We want people to have the opportunity. What does that mean specifically? We recognize that in any election, you have to make a choice, a practical choice. So poor and low wealth people are saying, we're going to evaluate candidates. Then we're going to see who's closest to our agenda. We're going to vote for them. And then after the election, we're going to push them. You know, I wish that the media would decide that they're going to have one debate on nothing but poverty, on what's affecting 50% of this nation. And then have the questions come from poor and low wealth people. So it can't be something that folks skate around.
Reverend, what do you tell activists who are overwhelmed by this poverty, they're overwhelmed by this injustice? What do you tell them to keep giving them hope to continue?
Well, the ones that I'm meeting are telling me they can't give up. As we move around the country, you know, we're not organized from the top down. Every state we went in, New Mexico, we were invited in. They invited us in. Because when people figure out that they have a right to be, to exist, and then they figure out they've been lied to. A lot of people have figured that out during COVID. We've been lied to. Every time, 7 months ago, people would tell us we didn't have money to do this. We didn't have money to do this. Well, how'd you find all this money all of a sudden? And then when people find out that they've been told that their vote doesn't matter, and they find out, wait a minute, you mean to tell me just 2% of us could change this? 20% could change here, 1% could change here. It shifts the whole attitude of the battle. People cannot continue to suffocate under the knee of police violence, under the knee of racism, and under the knee of poverty. There is something in the very inside of our souls that demands we have to fight to breathe. And that's what I think you're seeing in the streets. It's BLM, but I think if people just understand it as Black Lives Matter, they're missing it. It's people who, in the midst of COVID, have experienced so much that when George Floyd said, "I can't breathe," it was like shorthand for what many people are experiencing. It is actually the hope of America. People don't understand the protest is the hope. It means people do not believe that this democracy is beyond being changed and fixed and being made better.
Reverend Barr, thank you for joining us here. We really appreciate it, and we're honored to have you.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
Voter suppression. It is a dirty tactic that's been used for a long time here in the United States. Here to talk with me about efforts to fight voter suppression here in the great state of New Mexico, I have Andrea Serrano. She's the executive director of OLE, Organizers in the Land of Enchantment. Andrea, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how serious is the issue here in New Mexico, and who is the most affected?
What we see a lot in New Mexico is more of a subtle threat. You know, people have felt very intimidated to go and vote because they either can't get to the polls or they live in rural areas where it's really hard to get to a polling location. And we saw during the primary with the pandemic, especially on tribal lands, you know, with lockdowns that were happening, when you have that already and then you layer it with people sowing a lot of distrust around mail-in voting and absentee voting, the safest way to vote is for people to vote by mail. Troops have been doing it for decades and decades and decades. People have been voting absentee for a really long time. It's a safe and secure system. But when you have someone who's intentionally trying to sabotage a really safe way of voting, that on its face is voter suppression. Who's affected by that are mostly people of color. And in New Mexico, the rates that we're turning out to vote don't match our population, which means we're not being represented at the polls.
What are some of the ways that people are being misinformed about their right to vote? Are tools like social media and robocalls and mailers with the wrong information being used?
What we're seeing now is much more of a technological threat. So what we see are actually bots, and they're not real social media accounts, but they mimic real social media accounts. And what they do is they actually sow discord among voters. They start putting out these really negative messages like, you know, our votes don't matter and they don't listen to us anyway. And, you know, we shouldn't vote because they don't care about us anyway. And they target Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
What can communities do to make sure that they are informed about their own voting rights?
Trusting the New Mexico Secretary of State website, nmvote.org, joining our Know Your Rights webinar on Monday night, but also checking out other organizations and the information that they have is going to be really key.
Question about showing up to actually vote in person. Say someone is standing in line and someone comes up and tries to intimidate them. What can people do?
So we'll be sponsoring a hotline at OLE. Our phone number at the office is 505-796-6544. We actually will be receiving calls so that we can then work with the appropriate county clerk's office or the Secretary of State's office to activate a team who would be able to actually protect that person's right to vote. I think what's really important to note is that poll observers are actually allowed. But, you know, when you have a group of people that you're saying, this election is going to be rigged and it's going to be fraudulent and we need to make sure that it isn't rigged, that isn't encouraging people to go out and be peaceful poll observers. And because we've seen the presence of domestic terror groups like the New Mexico Civil Guard and the Proud Boys, you know, there's that group down in southern New Mexico, you know, the Cowboys for Trump. They show up at events to intimidate people. They show up, you know, the Civil Guard with assault rifles at a peaceful protest. We have to let these folks know under no uncertain terms that we are aware of them, that we're watching them, and that we're not going to be intimidated by them.
That is right. I want to thank you very much for being on the show. She is Andrea Serrano, Executive Director of OLE, Organizers in the Land of Enchantment. Thanks again, Andrea.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
After African Americans achieved the right to vote decades ago, tools of voter suppression quickly arrived. They've been used ever since. Here to talk with me about the importance of getting out the vote in the African American community is Rodney Bowe. He's with the New Mexico Black Voters Collaborative. Rodney, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Khalil. Wonderful to be on your show, man.
I want to talk about voting and the importance of it. Tell me about the Get Out the Vote efforts.
The New Mexico Black Voters Collaborative is working to bring New Mexico's Black community, as well as everybody that's in our circle, together to register to vote, to mobilize around certain key issues, and to really educate and get people to understand how important their vote is.
You know, what are some of the major concerns when it comes to voter suppression in the African-American community?
You know, one of the biggest things that I see is people really understanding that their vote matters. A lot of people believe that, well, my vote is only one vote and it's not going to matter, but collectively, it's going to be a very powerful voice.
There have been many efforts, some are still ongoing, to prevent African-Americans and other communities of color from voting. This was emphasized in the Senate's most recent report on Russia's social media misinformation campaign that was targeted directly towards African-Americans to dissuade them from voting. Do you feel confident in the government's response for this election cycle? Not only the federal government, do you feel confident in what the state government and local officials are doing?
I truly do. And I think the biggest thing is you have to educate yourself on the laws. It's imperative.
When I was in school, they taught us about our voting rights. Do you feel that it'd be necessary to talk to some state legislators about making it a requirement to, at least in high school, begin teaching all of our students about voting rights?
For me, one of the biggest pieces that I picked up as I was deciding to participate in the New Mexico Black Voters Collaborative was the definition of democracy. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had to think about what is democracy. And I just went to Merriam-Webster, and it's, you know, it's government in which the supreme power is vested in the people and exercised by them directly or indirectly through a system of representation, usually involving periodically held free elections. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't have to think about, at my age, what democracy is about. If we're not getting it in school, which it would be great to have it in school and having our legislatures to push for that. But our community, with the technology that we have, we should be teaching each other. Just sitting down with our circle of influence and talking about voting and our civic duty to get out and vote.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And finally, what can be done as far as people who are listening right now? How can we help to spread the word?
Make sure that everybody around you is voting. There's a New Mexico online voters registration portal with the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And there's also a website, All You Need to Know Voting, that will give some really key important information, as well as if you go to FAQS about voting, there's information there as well.
All right. All right, we're going to send the people there. He is Rodney Bowe. He is with the New Mexico Black Voters Collaborative. Rodney, thank you for being on the show, my man.
Thank you for having me. Keep doing the things that you're doing. You're really blessing this community, and keep stepping.
Yes, sir. You know I will. Politicians and judges on your ballot this year have made decisions in response to the coronavirus pandemic that immediately impacted the health of the community and the economy. As a part of our Voices Behind the Vote series, KUNM's Nash Jones spoke with Albuquerque voter Georgia Petropoulos, who owns Casa San Pueblo, a senior living home, about how these decisions affected her small business and now inform her vote.
My name is Georgia Petropoulos. I'm currently an assisted living administrator and owner. When the pandemic first came to our awareness, I felt pretty scared. And my primary responsibility was to keep our residents safe. It has changed the way we build confidence and trust. It's a very difficult decision for families because we have to quarantine residents for 14 days upon move-in. And visitations have been highly regulated by the state. I think when we look at the decisions that have been made, I think they were made with good intent, and I'm going to do my best to keep that good intention in focus with how to best take care of the residents and try and explain that to families and try and help the residents not feel so lonely. Anything that we can do to protect each other and work in compassion are so important. I will vote with the candidate that has good intention to protect our citizens best we can. And I know that that's very, very, very difficult because people's livelihoods are at stake. But I just know that if we have been successful one time, we know how to do it again. But our priorities have to be to protect each other first. I think that we're going to come out of this situation better people.
I come from a family where both of my grandmothers were immigrants. And I remember them studying for their citizenship, and I remember how important it was to them. I was very little, but that had a profound impact on me that my grandmothers became citizens after I was born, and that they were so proud of that citizenship, and I will always vote. I hope I can do right by them.
All right, that's it for this week. Remember, if you run into trouble as you vote, call 1-866-OUR-VOTE. Voting rights advocates will be waiting to hear from you. Common Cause also has hotlines for people who speak other languages. Find all those numbers at commoncause.org. Special thanks to Ty Bannerman, Kaveh Movahed, Hannah Colton, and Yasmin Khan for the editing help this week, and to our media partner New Mexico PBS and reporter Russell Contreras for the interview with Reverend Barber. Shout out to Nash Jones for the awesome reporting. The artwork for this week's online episode comes from Felicia Montoya, Marcus Wall, and Kema, who created a mural in Albuquerque's North Valley and shared photos with us, and also from Ileana Rodriguez. Thanks to Cheo, Jazz Tone, the producer, Dom Life, Olaud Records for providing music to the show. Khaki, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt produced some of the show's themes. This show is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco and hosted and produced by yours truly. For everyone, peace out, and let's not screw up the country any further, all right? Go out there and vote. I'm Khalil Ekolona. Thanks for listening.